This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome, everyone, to Compassionate Light Temple in the Zendo and via Zoom. Good to see many old friends and new friends as well. Zen is ultimately impossible to define, and yet within this Zen tradition, certain things are emphasized, and because it's part of Buddhism. And Buddha, as you may know, in Sanskrit means awake. So in English, we could say Buddhism is awakeism. Awakeningism, the path of awakening and awakeness. And Zen tends to emphasize that aspect. And also Zen emphasizes this lineage of ancestors going back to the Buddha and these face-to-face meetings between teachers and students, starting with the awakened one, the Buddha, and passing on some direct experience of awakening through generation after generation, through many centuries in India, and many centuries in China, many centuries in Japan, and less than a century in America. But May it last for many centuries throughout the world, this unique practice and realization of Zen. Awakening is one of these words that we can toss around easily and not really define it. And a lot could be said about it, but it seems to me like in the Zen tradition, especially, that the awakening is referring to a shift of perspective. And a pivotal shift of perspective that really tends to change the life of these ancestors. And again, a lot could be said about it, but a lot of the Zen stories, maybe the vast majority of so-called Zen stories, like the koan stories and dialogue stories of Zen, almost all of them are about this pivotal shift of perspective we call awakening. In China and Japan, they use the word Satori. So in our particular lineage, all these ancestors from the time of Buddha through India, China, and Japan, they all have a particular story about their great Satori. Satori is this Chinese word that just means, literally means like understanding or realization. We could say awakening. It's not necessarily a Buddhist term. It's just in the language, it just means to understand or to realize, to grok something in a new way that we haven't realized before. That's why we can speak of it as a shift of perspective. And so the awakening stories, the Satori stories of the Zen ancestors are passed along because they're showing us how all the shift of perspective worked for many, many different people, hearing different things. And also, it may be surprising to some to hear that the ancestors of our lineage, we have the present day ancestors are like the 92nd, 93rd generation. We don't know all the details of the stories, maybe in the more recent centuries in Japan, but the stories that got recorded of these Satori shifts of perspective, the surprising part may be that almost all of these awakenings happened when hearing words. You might think, well, we're supposed to be silent in the retreat, and because words are kind of distracting and they just get us into a conceptual thinking. But I don't think I've ever heard of any awakening stories of the Zen ancestors that happened when they were just sitting silently. Not surprising. We should talk. But in fact, they did do a lot of silent sitting. So that was essential to their awakenings. But we might look at it as the silent sitting is just like setting the ground. It's kind of like it's creating a kind of open, porous, flexible mind and heart that's ready to hear words in a new way. And it may be that sometimes a Zen person has a kind of shift of perspective in Zazen when they're remembering words that they heard earlier. But the shift of perspective we call awakening or Satori almost always comes with hearing. Sometimes it comes with hearing things other than words, like hearing the sound of a pebble striking bamboo. And today I want to talk about this Zen ancestor Keizan and one of his awakenings, hearing words. But Keizan had another shift of perspective at one point here when sitting Zazen, but hearing the wind come through the window of the Zendo. When he heard the sound of the wind coming through the window, it shifted his perspective somehow. But Keizan's one record of Keizan's great awakening was hearing these words. So who's Keizan? In our Zen lineage of ancestors, that lineage was passed from China to Japan in the 13th century through Dogen Zenji, really kind of the founder of this Soto school of Zen in the 1200s. He went to China and met his teacher and heard some words, as the story goes. And upon hearing some words about dropping off body and mind, Dogen dropped off body and mind. And that was his shift of perspective. And he brought that back to Japan. And four generations later, this teacher, Keizan Jokin, appeared. And he's kind of considered the co-founder of Soto Zen in Japan. Dogen and Keizan are sometimes said to be like the father and mother of this lineage in Japan. Maybe Dogen was a little more like strict and austere and kind of like no frills kind of guy, maybe more fatherly type. And Keizan, why is he called the mother? Maybe because he kind of expanded the repertoire of Zen practices. He brought in other elements that maybe more people could relate to, and especially brought in like ceremonial practices, particularly for the lay people outside the monastery. I think this is just an aside, but I think it's interesting to hear that the way that that Keizan Zenji in the 1300s in Japan really popularized Soto Zen was not through Zazen for the lay sangha, non-monastic sangha, but through like kind of esoteric ceremonies. I say this is interesting because I think we might think in modern times that the esoteric ceremonies are for the people in the monasteries because they're kind of weird, but Zazen is like for everybody. But in this time in Japan, it was the opposite. Zazen was considered this really difficult, esoteric kind of difficult practice that only people, the monks who were doing it in the monasteries, could even understand what Zazen was. But these ceremonies that were like, you know, calling on protector spirits and invoking Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as protection and aid, and also funeral ceremonies in traditional Zen way. These kinds of things are what actually the lay people could relate to in ancient Japan. Interesting how things change. Anyway, and Keizan was one who's brought in these ceremonies from like Vajrayana Buddhism. So the father and mother of Soto Zen. Many teachings of Dogen are recorded. We study them. Many teachings of Keizan are recorded. In particular, what Keizan is most known for is record of these Satori stories of all the ancestors from Shakyamuni Buddha, the Indian founder, up to Keizan's own first teacher in Japan. So there's like 53 ancestors. Each one has a story. Each one is hearing words, shifting their perspective. And Keizan records all those stories were already recorded. Keizan collects them and comments on them. But, you know, he didn't comment on his own story. So that's what I'll do today in honor of Keizan. Just a little bit more about Keizan's life before we get into the stories, just get a sense of him. He was born in the Fukui Prefecture near Dogen's monastery, Eheiji. So Soto Zen was, remember, kind of like Soto Zen in America now is this new movement in Japan. So all the teachers and practitioners were kind of still clustered in this one area called Fukui on the west coast of Japan, the main island. It was starting to spread a little bit around the country, but that was still the original landing place of the lineage. And Keizan was born 11 years after Dogen died. Born in 1264, and he was born to a Fujiwara family, which was a kind of powerful political leaders in Japan at that time. And his mother was really devout Buddhist and wanted him to leave home and be a monk. early on. So as was kind of common in those days, when Keizan was 12 years old, he went off to Eheji, the newish monastery, and started practicing Zen and received the precepts and was ordained as a priest by Ko-un Ejo, a disciple of Dogen. And after Ejo died, Keizan became a student of Tetsu Gikai, who was his lifelong teacher. And so after 5 years of practicing Zen full-time in Eheji Monastery, Keizan left and went on pilgrimage. So he's only 17 years old now. It's nice to start young. And pilgrimage in those days was like visiting different teachers in different temples around the country. Zen was still new, so there weren't that many Zen teachers. It was like less than a century. Lots of other Buddhist teachers, but Keizan did go and practice with Jakuin, who was actually a Chinese Zen teacher who came from China to practice Zen with Dogen. And he was like in the area. So Keizan spent some time with him. He spent some time with some Rinzai Zen teachers like Kakushin. And the Rinzai Zen teachers were into these Vajrayana esoteric ceremonies. So he learned a lot of that from the Rinzai teachers. And he even went to Mount Hiei, which is the headquarters of the Tendai school of Japan, and learned their way. So it was very ecumenical. He didn't have to stick to Zen, kind of checking out the popular Buddhism of his time in Japan. And then he came back after 5 years of, or some years, I don't know how many years of wandering around, visiting different teachers. He came back to practice with his root teacher, Tetsu Gikai. And when Gikai moved from Eheji to another temple, Daijoji, young Keizan followed his teacher. There was some, I mean, a lot could be said about this history, which I find fascinating, but there was some kind of controversy at this time at Eheji, the main Soto monastery in Japan, around Keizan's teacher, Tetsu Gikai. There was like a sort of split in the Sangha. I think there's political stuff going on. And you know, if this happens in modern America, the Sanghas have trouble, and we'd say, well, it's because we're these barbarian Americans and we can't practice like the ancients. They had their problems too. In the early Japanese Soto school, it's not exactly clear what happened, but it looks like Tetsu Gikai was almost like kicked out of the monastery. But he had his students that went with him. Keizan was like Gikai's attendant, like the Jisha. So kind of took care of his old teacher. And one time Keizan's teacher was giving a talk in Zendo, maybe like this. And he mentioned this story that we're gonna hear about ordinary mind is the way. And when Keizan heard that story, he had this great satori, this pivotal shift of perspective, this awakening at age 30. You could say that's young, but remember, he started practicing at 12. So he'd been doing this for a while. And we'll come back to the story in a minute, but to finish Keizan's life events, the year after this pivotal awakening at age 31, Keizan inherited the Dharma from his teacher, Tetsu Gikai, early days of Dharma transmission in Japan. And then he was like an independent teacher. And so he went to another temple to teach and moved around, came back to Daijoji, took care of his aging teacher, and then inherited that monastery when his teacher died. And and then he transmitted the Dharma to Gassan Joseki and to others, and Kaizen founded like at least four other monasteries. He didn't just stay in one place. He kind of gave it to his students to take care of and went somewhere else to a new town and started a new place. So he was really into kind of spreading this really new thing of Soto Zen in Japan. He was really like a popularizer, really got it going. And then it really took off after Kaizen, like in the next 50 years, hundreds and then thousands of temples and monasteries all over Japan in Kaizen's lineage. All of Soto Zen comes through Dogen and Kaizen. And after Kaizen, it starts splitting into different lineages. And another piece about Kaizen is that he had quite a few women students. Dogen, we have a record of Dogen, the one who brought it from China to Japan, at least one woman priest, but she was never inherited his Dharma. Her name is Egi. But Kaizen started transmitting the Dharma to four different women, maybe other women students too, but he passed on the lineage to four women. This was the first that this had happened in Japan. And I think also in this particular Soto lineage in China, there were women, but I don't think we have any of their names. We have other Chinese Zen women ancestor names, but I don't think they're this particular lineage because of conditions, right? Because of like blind spots, I think, in the society and the way there were women practitioners, but their stories often didn't get recorded. Maybe Kaizen saw this as a flaw and transmitted the Dharma to these four women, and now we do have their names and some stories. And I think they started women's monasteries, and I don't know if their lineages continued all the way up to the present. That would be interesting to research. I think they maybe had less support, so they might have died out. And of course now in all around the world there's many Soto Zen women lineage holders, but these were the first. Could have been the first ever in this particular lineage, but definitely the first in Japan. One named Ekyu. Kinto Ekyu was the first Soto Zen woman ancestor to receive Dharma transmission from Kaizen in Japan. Eikan was another one. Actually, it was Kaizen's mother, the one who really was already a devout practitioner and kind of sent him off at age 12 to go practice Zen. Later, she became his Dharma heir and became an abbess of a women's community. Mokufu Sonin was an important like donor, helped found the, she came from a wealthy family. She helped start, I think, Yokoji or Daijoji, gave land to Kaizen for the monasteries. And then later, she was ordained and became a successor of Kaizen. And Myosho Enkan is another successor of Kaizen, woman, Kaizen's cousin, who is an abbess of another temple. So I appreciate this part about Kaizen, that he really wanted to not keep it as a men's thing, Zen movement. And then like in our lineages now coming up to Suzuki Roshi and to Kogen Chino Roshi, I think from Kaizen up to those present day teachers, I don't think there were women in those particular lineages. There were other women's lineages, offshoot branches. But now, of course, there are. In in America and Europe. And I think it's going to continue like this. We have some right here. And so that's a little of Kazan's story. But really, I want to bring up this this pivotal awakening story. So this morning's talk, you can hear this is the story, the Chinese Zen story that Kazan heard. And when he heard the story, he had this awakening. And then this afternoon, we can hear when Kazan kind of got it, when he had this awakening in this Dharma talk, how he expressed that to his teacher. Because part of awakening is this pivotal shift of perspective. And the other part of it is being able to express it and in a fresh way. So I think that's a very interesting story too. Can save that for this afternoon. The dialogue between Kazan and his teacher around this awakening. But here's the story that Kazan heard. And I think this is interesting because it's a story about a Chinese Zen ancestor from the 800s, so maybe like 500 years earlier. Because all these Zen stories are about awakenings. So Kazan heard the story about somebody else's awakening. Another great Satori story. And then Kazan, hearing that story, had his own great awakening, hearing about somebody else's awakening. And this is kind of this thing of Zen. This is this kind of style of Zen. Usually, I mean, modern days we're experimenting, I think, more and more with all different ways, different new kinds of stories. But it looks like traditionally, for the since the time of maybe Bodhidharma in the 6th century, up to at least through these people, Kazan, Dogen and Kazan in the 1300s and afterwards, almost always the style of Zen was hearing these stories of Zen awakenings and having awakenings, hearing the stories. I think we still do this in modern America, but it's not the only thing we do. But since it's kind of the style of our lineage, I want to keep doing it. I want to keep telling these stories because they're really dear to my heart, and they really can shift our perspective. So this story that Kazan heard is a story from the 800s. They say the golden age of Zen in China, in the Tang Dynasty. And it's a story about Nan Chuan and Zhao Zhou. So Nan Chuan was a Zen teacher, and Zhao Zhou was a young Zen student who later became one of the great teachers of China. But this is the time when he's first going to, when he first meets his teacher, Zhao Zhou. There's many stories about Zhao Zhou, like, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou said, no. That's maybe the most famous story of Zhao Zhou. But this is another one. This is when Zhao Zhou is a student asking his teacher, what is the way? What is the way? And so this word way is in Chinese the Dao. So this is an example of one of those terms from so-called Daoism, wayism, that kind of they used to talk about Buddhist awakening. They used some of the Taoist language when Buddhism came from India to China. So the way is like Chinese translation of awakening. And it's also a Chinese translation of like the path that leads to awakening. Dao is is such an important word in China before Buddhism came, and they used it to translate the Sanskrit word marga, which means path, and also to translate the Sanskrit word bodhi, which means awakening. So, and the word way in English, I think it's really good translation for Dao because it has that double meaning in English, right? Like the way to something, like a path. The word way has that meaning, but it also has the meaning of like the way it is. So the word way in English, I think, captures the path aspect of the way, and the just this is the way it is way. See how those are kind of different meanings? And the word Dao covers both of those Buddhist meanings, and the English word way covers both those meanings. So what is the way is a big question. It means like, what is the path to awakening and what is awakening? And maybe in the non-duality of Zen, say that the path to awakening and the awakening are not really two separate things anyway. So it's the essential question, right? What is the way? And Nan Chuang, the teacher, replied, ordinary mind is the way. And this word ordinary in Sino-Japanese is this compound, heijo. Hei means like, it's the same as the A of Eheiji, which sometimes we say eternal peace temple, but so you could say eternal, but also like even, peaceful. Maybe we say it's the peace of eternal peace, peaceful level and ordinary, it means. And the word jo in this compound also means like ordinary or continuous. When we say impermanence is a big teaching in Buddhism, right? Impermanence in Japanese, that's mujo. So means like no continuity or no permanence. But jo means like permanence or eternal, or so they both hei and jo mean like always the case. And then as a compound in Chinese, it means ordinary. So this is a whole Chinese language sort of lesson, right? But you can see how that would come to be, like the compound that means ordinary is like what is always the case. Ordinary is like, it's always like this. And it's plain and simple, ordinary, common, and always. So I think it's nice to know that this word ordinary also implies something that's always the case. So what is the way? Ordinary mind is the way, but we could also kind of look at it as, what is the way? The mind that is always the case, the mind that is unchanging, the unchanging mind is the way. You could also look at it like that. Ordinary and always the case mind, ordinary and always ever present mind is the way. So we hear the phrase ordinary mind, we think, well, that's my just thinking mind, my when I'm sitting zazen, my mind that's just chattering away about the past and future. We might think, well, that's ordinary mind. But in fact, when you hear the other Zen ancestors talk about this phrase, because a lot of them use this phrase, ordinary mind, they're not referring to that chattering mind. They're referring to that aspect of our mind that's always the case. It's always the same. Ordinary and plain, but that element of our mind that doesn't ever change. Whereas the chattering mind is always chattering about some different thing. So it's not about the content of our chattering mind. It's about, you could say, even the background of just present awareness that's always the same. No matter what the chatter is about, there's this background that's just aware of whatever's happening. And it's always aware in the same way. And it's very ordinary. It's so plain. It's so unexciting, which is why we don't pay attention to it very much. Because we're into interesting things, like the content of our chatter. That's interesting. Like what that person said to me yesterday, and like what I'm going to have for lunch later today. That's interesting. That stuff's changing all. We might even say that chatter about content of our thoughts, that's extraordinary, extraordinary stuff. That's why we're so interested in the content of our thoughts. But this ordinary background awareness is so ordinary and plain and level and even. These are all kind of definitions of this term that we just don't even notice. But here is the most important Zen question. What is the way? What is awakening and what is the path? Ordinary mind is ever present, unchanging, plain old, level, unexciting, uninteresting mind. That's is awakening and is the path to awakening. So this is Zazen instruction. There's some element of our experience that's always the same, in a very ordinary way. And while we're sitting today, we can open to that element of our experience that's always the same. It's hard to open to it because we're into the elements of our experience that are always different. They're much more interesting. But we can learn this backward step that shifts our awareness from involvement in the content of experience to that which is ever present and aware. So this is the beginning of the story. What is the way? Ordinary mind is the way. And then young Zhaozhou asks his teacher, continuing the dialogue, well, should I direct my attention towards it? I mean, this is the way, right? So it's the most important thing, especially for people like Zhaozhou, who's like, yeah, I gave up everything to just follow the Zen path. So it's the most important thing. It's the meaning of my life is the way and clarifying the way. So I hear ordinary mind is the way. Well, shouldn't I pay attention to it? You could hear his question like that. Or how should I direct my attention towards it? Should I direct my attention towards ordinary mind? That's the question. And teacher Nanchuan says, if you try to turn towards it, you become separated from it. If you try to direct your attention towards ordinary mind, you actually get further from ordinary. How frustrating. This is the most important thing, ordinary mind. Okay, let's direct our attention towards it. Where is it? Where is it? Well, if you try to turn towards it or direct yourself towards it, direct your attention towards it, you actually go astray from it. What wonderful, this is wonderful, subtle Zazen instruction. There is an element of our experience that's always present and aware and at ease. Because it never changes, it never becomes suffering. It's always okay. There's an element of our experience that's always okay, even when my thoughts are not okay. This situation is not okay. There's this awareness in the background that it's okay. Always okay. So that's why this is so liberating to discover this ordinary mind. It's the mind that's always okay, even when our thoughts and emotions are not doing okay. If we can find this element, there can be some freedom in any situation. So this is no small matter. So, okay, where is it? Should I try to find it? Should I direct my attention towards it? And the teacher says, if you direct your attention towards it, you go astray from it. Why would he say that? Could it be that it's because it's not another thought? It's not another object of mind. It's not another content of experience. It's the experiencing of all the content. And we can't really direct our attention towards experiencing itself. We can only direct our attention towards the objects of experience, like colors and sounds and sensations and thoughts and emotions. We can direct our attention there, but that ever-present, aware being, we can't direct our attention to it because it's not located anywhere. It's everywhere and it's nowhere. It's not an experience. Which is experience is something that arises and ceases. And that experiencing of all experiences does not arise and cease. So if this ordinary mind is the way, if it is awakening, then I think it's fair to say that awakening, actually, strictly speaking, is not another experience. If we think of it that way, that we kind of go astray from it. We could say awakening is the ever-present experiencing of all experiences and kind of being that, being in accord with that which is always the case. So should I direct my attention toward it? Jiaozhou asked. And Nanchuan said, if you turn towards it, you become separate from it. And then Jiaozhou asks, well, how can I know the way unless I try to attend to it? Unless I try to direct my attention towards it, how can I know it? Because don't we want to know it this way? Don't we want to realize awakening? In this case, he's using the word knowing. How can I know it? That's our mission here as these Zen practitioners. We want to know the way directly. So Jiaozhou says, if I don't direct my attention towards it, well, I can hear that there's a way that's ever peaceful and present and always the case. But if I don't know it for myself directly, what good is that? I don't want to take this on hearsay. And it's part of the Zen style here, right? Don't take this stuff on hearsay. We have to verify for ourselves. So how can I know the way unless I try to turn towards it, or direct my attention towards it? And Nanchuan, the teacher, says, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is false perception, he says. And I think what he's referring to is the usual way we know things, like the way that we know that that's a window there, Oh, we know that that bell is made of bronze. These kinds of knowing is actually false perception. It's kind of objective knowing. It's conceptual knowing. I think that's what he's pointing to here. Knowing is false perception, but not knowing is just like blankness or confusion. Jiajia says, the way is not a matter of knowing in the way we usually know things, objectively and dualistically. It's not like that kind of knowing, but it's also not just not knowing. Well, it's just stop thinking and just veg out. It's not like that either. That's just non-mindfulness. That's like spacing out, we might say in modern language. That's just spacing out, kind of like sort of dull, sort of wallowing. That's not the way. So I got it. This is a stick. No, that's not it. So this is sometimes how the Zen people talk. Jiajia's maybe getting more and more frustrated. Okay, we can't know it in the usual way of knowing things. We can't just forget about knowing. But what about this ordinary mind is the way? So teacher Nanchuan says, when you have truly reached the way beyond doubt and beyond trying, you will find it as vast and boundless as open space. How can this be talked about in terms of affirmation and negation, in terms of this and that, right and wrong, in terms of all these dualities? And when Yom Jiajia heard these words, he came to a sudden awakening, Satori. What is the way? Ordinary mind is the way. Should I direct my attention toward it? If you turn toward it, you become separate from it. Well, how can I know the way if I don't direct myself toward it? The way is not a matter of knowing it or not knowing it. Knowing is false perception, a kind of deluded, dualistic perception. Not knowing is just blankness or spacing out. But if you truly reach the way, verify the way beyond any doubt, beyond seeking it, you will find it as vast and boundless as open space. It's everywhere. There's nowhere it's not. This, all of everything that's happening is awareness. And this awareness can't be located, it can't be grasped, it can't be known. It can't be turned towards, it can't be turned away from, it can't be avoided, it can't be lost, it can't be found. And yet, how could we say that awareness is lacking, this peaceful present awareness that is always the case, whatever the particulars of our experiences. We can hear such things and discover this subtle and yet ordinary reality that's always present, but it's not a thing. It's not even an experience. It is the unchanging experiencing of all experiences that everybody shares. All sentient beings are experiencing 24/7, even in deep sleep, even in dreams, the same identical awareness, always peaceful. Even a nuclear explosion doesn't touch it. Even our own death doesn't change it in any way. How can this be talked about in terms of like, it's like this, or it's like that, or it exists, or it doesn't exist? It doesn't fall into these categories. And with these words, Jiaojiu realized this awakening. His perspective shifted. Shift of perspective could be the slightest thing, like, huh. Could be just like, I never thought of that. I've been paying attention to the content of my experience since the moment I was born, but it never occurred to me that all that stuff is happening in this ungraspable, unlocated, unfindable awareness. I never noticed the awareness itself because it's not an experience, and it's kind of ordinary. It's so ordinary that I didn't ever even notice it. So it could be like, that could be the shift of perspective. Huh. Interesting. Okay, what's the next experience? That's, come on, something juicy, interesting. But we could, if we have a lot of time, or we're just sitting on a cushion with nothing particular to do, experiences are not that exciting in Zazen, we could start exploring this ever-present awareness. Again, we can't direct ourselves towards it. We can't find it. We can't turn towards it. And yet, we can, if we forget it, we can ask, is awareness present? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, is this awareness peaceful? Actually, my knee is really hurting after several hours of sitting, so it's not peaceful. Well, wait a second. Now we're talking about an experience of knee pain. But is the awareness of the knee pain painful? Actually, the awareness seems to be like the same awareness as the awareness of a really good lunch. And the awareness of the sound of the bird seems to be like the same awareness as the awareness of the motorcycles all driving by. So the content keeps differing, and we have these preferences around content, but the just pure awareness of them seems to always be in this peaceful, present being. We can explore it. We can explore, can we find it? Does it have any edges? Does it have any center? Does it come and go? And when we're looking color or listening to a sound, is that sound and color something other than the awareness? Is it something in addition to the awareness? Or is it actually just the awareness taking the form of color and sound temporarily, without itself actually changing, without the awareness actually changing? These are things we can explore in Zazen. And they might shift our perspective a little or a lot. I mean, when I say that all these Zen ancestors, their awakening stories always came with hearing some words, it is important to know that they probably all logged a few thousand hours of Zazen before they heard these particular shifting words. but not always. There's some Zen stories of before any Zazen at all. I think of the sixth ancestor in China as a famous example of, he never heard of Zen or Buddhism or anything. He was just a woodcutter walking through the marketplace one day, and he heard somebody at their, you know, the fruit stand reciting the Diamond Sutra. And he, as he was walking by, he heard the words of the sutra. A bodhisattva should give rise to a non-abiding mind. And when he heard that phrase from the sutra, he had this shift of perspective. Whoa! He must have been pretty open and attentive to even notice those words, but he heard it and I went, what is that? So something happened when I heard that. And I said, oh, it's a Diamond Sutra. And the one who was to become the sixth ancestor of Zen in Japan, in China, said, well, where can I find out more? Something is striking my heart deeply here. I said, well, why don't you go meet the fifth ancestor of Zen? He can tell you more about this kind of thing, about this non-abiding mind. Okay. And he just like quit his job as a woodcutter and went off to the temple of the fifth ancestor. So that's a story where with no Zazen or understanding at all, words struck his mind and a shift of perspective happened. So that's the story of Nan Chuan and Zhao Zhou. It's one of my favorite Zen stories, actually, because I think it really is a nice Zazen instruction. And it's a nice dialogue. And it's young Zhao Zhou is persistent. This is a good way to be as a student, right? Student, you can go to a teacher and ask, what is the way? And they say, ordinary mind is the way. And you can say, okay, thanks. I got to ask somebody else another question now. Or you can be persistent. Okay, ordinary mind's the way, but what about that? Continue until you're satisfied. And that might take many, many dialogues with the teacher, but it was just one sort of extended dialogue that satisfied Zhao Zhou in this case. But in fact, he was, I think, in his 20s and then stayed with his teacher, Nan Chuan, for I think 40 more years, something like that. So it wasn't the end, it was kind of the beginning for young Zhao Zhou. Shift of perspective isn't the be all and end all, but it shows what's possible. And so then we know what it's about, this practice, and then we can eventually extend that and stabilize a new perspective, and then act and then express that. So this afternoon story is how Kazan, 500 years later, heard this story that we just heard about Zhao Zhou's awakening, and then Kazan had an awakening just hearing that story, as far as we know. But then his teacher wanted him to express it. But before we finish this morning, any questions about this story of ordinary mind being the way? How we might practice with it in Zazen? Yes.
I'm just curious. These are guys from a long time ago. Some of the Roshi was, what are the fools of Earl?
Yeah.
What's the modern?
Yeah. And of course, the Suzuki Roshi and Koban Roshi told a lot of these stories too, right? I did hear, they aren't always so dramatic, right? And they don't always come in words. I think many people have little shifts of perspective hearing words from teachers or even sometimes reading something. Sometimes, wow, let me get it. There, these days, it's like YouTube and all that, right? But in the old days, they didn't have that. So it was always face-to-face. But I think even in modern times, face-to-face is the best. Right? It's better than YouTube. It's better than the book because it's here and now meeting. But one story just of Suzuki Roshi. Also, it's kind of customary that teachers often don't talk about their own awakenings, right? It's sort of in Zen, there's it's a little like out of humility, and they often don't get into those stories. They let their students tell the stories. But Suzuki Roshi kind of implied that he had some shift, some sort of awakening. The story that I heard, this is recorded in Crooked Cucumber, The Life of Suzuki Roshi. One time when he was a young priest living in a family temple, it was a hot summer day like this, and Suzuki Roshi and the other young priests at the temple said, let's get a watermelon, let's eat a watermelon. And you know, temples in Japan were pretty poor at that time, so they knew there was a watermelon for some special occasion, probably like Sunday when the visitors came, they'd break out the watermelon for lunch, and so that, you know, the kids shouldn't just eat it. It's in the storeroom. But mischievous young Shunryu Suzuki, I'll go get that watermelon. I know it's down there, and I'll bring it back. We can share it, right? They'll never know it's missing. And I don't know if I remember all the details, but something like he went downstairs to the basement storeroom where the watermelon was, and turned on the light and saw the melon over there and picked it up and was about to leave when he heard footsteps coming down the steps. Maybe his father, the temple priest, someone coming. Oh no! So he turned off the light quickly. And then in the dark, tried to move to like a corner of the room to hide with the watermelon. But as he was moving in the dark, incidental, interesting kind of correlation to this afternoon's story we're going to hear about moving through the dark. Keizan is going to talk about moving through the dark. But in this case, young Suzuki moving through the dark. And there was some sort of hook on the ceiling like, to hang things on, but a sharp hook, but it was pitch black. And his almost like his eye, right next to his eye, caught on the hook in the dark. Ah! And, like, you know, went right through his skin, and he couldn't get it out because he was holding the watermelon. But he was like hooked on this hook. Whoever came down the stairs, maybe to turn off to see if the light was on or something, left. So young Suzuki was hanging by this hook, and he could feel the blood dripping down on his hands and feet, and was standing there. And then I guess I'm caught, and I guess I got to get help. So we started yelling for help, but I guess the door was thick and nobody could hear him. So he was hanging there, bleeding in the pitch black, dark, hanging by this hook, waiting in zazen, standing zazen for something to happen for like hours. And afterwards he said, that was my first kind of awakening. Something happened there, hanging in the dark by this hook. Some shift happened.
Yes.
So he didn't hear any words, but it was maybe a dramatic circumstance. I think for big shifts, it often happens in more dramatic situations, or which might be just a conversation, but if one's been sitting a lot of zazen, conversations can be really charged and potent. So I like it's a sheen, like a longer Zen retreat. It's nice to go to Dokusan and talk with, meet with a teacher face to face, because each word feels like it's potent. Our words and the other's words are like, what are these words? And we try to choose the essential words. I think that's what we're going to hear Keizan's story this afternoon. That was one story. I think I also heard Koban Roshi. Maybe Shoho Mike knows this story or another. I think I read somewhere someone was asking Koban about awakening, and he said one time at a Heiji, the same place where Keizan practiced in the 1300s, Koban practiced, and Suzuki Roshi practiced in the 1900s. Still going strong in Fukui Prefecture. And in that monastery, Koban was there, and it was winter Rohatsu Sashin, and something like they came out of Zazen, and unexpectedly, it had snowed, silently snowed really deeply. So Eheiji was covered in this white glow of snow at dawn as the sun was rising. And when Koban just unexpectedly looked out the open door into the world of whiteness, there was some shift of perspective. Did you ever hear that story, Mike? I can't remember where I read that in some talks of Koban's. So it was like, see, maybe we could say, even if it doesn't come in words, it comes with an interaction with the senses. So words come through hearing, and the sound of a pebble on bamboo comes through the hearing sense. And that Koban story, whether that's true or not, was seeing something, and Suzuki Roshi was feeling something with the sensory field. Something about maybe the way that the five senses are usually dualistic, are usually divided into a knower and a known, but in really direct experience, the seeing is one with the seer, and the heard is one with the hearer. There's just seeing, there's just hearing, undivided awareness without a subject and an object. Undivided feeling of painful sensation. Any other questions? Yes, Corinne.
When you were talking about knowing, the kinds of knowing, the word unself-conscious knowing popped into my mind, and I wondered if you might, address that or see if it's pertaining to the defining that you were using.
Sounds good. Unself-conscious knowing. Knowing, I think, can be just a synonym for awareness. I like to use the words knowing, awareness, and experiencing synonymously, but they have little different flavors. So it's nice to play with that in Zazen. Is experiencing present right now in Zazen? Of course it is. But I was just caught up in the experience. But is experiencing happening? It's a backwards step. So knowing, in the sense that you're talking about here, can mean boundless, unlocated, timeless awareness. And that is unself-conscious, means it's like self-conscious would be, I think we usually use the word self-conscious as like when we're overly focused on the individual perceiving self, like we're embarrassed in a group or something because we're thinking too much about the subject side, So self-consciousness kind of like blocks, seems to block or obscure the non-dual knowing. And also self-consciousness does that, but also other consciousness does that. Oh, I wonder how that other person over there, that other thing over there, what's going on over there? That also obscures it. So self-consciousness and other consciousness both seem to block the knowing that is not divided into self and other, subject and object. The boundless knowing that's like space. They seem to block it. Of course, nothing really can block space. Nothing can obscure space. But the seeming to obscure it seems to be a big problem for human beings. They get really caught in self and other, and we lose touch with the way that's vast and boundless is open space. So thank you. Let's do a little more zazen before lunch. There's a chant in near the beginning of the book.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.